Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
If you ask the average person in Illinois what the state's attorney general is doing these days, they might not answer very quickly because Kwame Raoul doesn't call very many news conferences. But his office has been very active on some of the state and the nation's most pressing issues, and we're going to bring you up to date this weekend. Hello, I'm political editor Craig Delamore, and this is At Issue. My guest this week is Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul. He's been leading the AG's office since January when he took over from Lisa Madigan. Before that, he was in the state Senate where he held a legislative seat vacated by Barack Obama when he went to the U.S. Senate. As a lawmaker, Kwame Raoul has distinguished himself as an advocate for voting rights, court reform, pensions, and ethics reform, among other things. Kwame Raoul, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
It's good to finally be able to talk to you as Attorney General. We've talked about you being Attorney General for so long. But we can't have any discussion about the top issues facing Illinois without talking about gun violence, which is also a major issue across the United States. Those deadly mass shootings in El Paso and Dayton, Ohio, and frankly, even the one most recently, the shootings of the police officers in Philadelphia, put some new energy into efforts for new gun laws. This week, you and about a dozen more attorneys general from across the U.S. filed a front of the court brief about gun safety regulations. Now, this involves a New York City case. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and especially why people in Illinois should care?
Well, the New York City case involves limitations that New York City has put on transporting firearms. And it's important, while this is a case germane to New York City, it's important to defend a municipality's capability to restrict trafficking of firearms within its jurisdiction. You know, we've got our own problem within the city of Chicago. We don't have any gun manufacturers or gun dealers within the city of Chicago, yet firearms are trafficked and transported from beyond the boundaries of the city of Chicago and beyond the boundaries of the state of Illinois, for that matter. And joining in with my colleagues from across the country to file an amicus brief defending New York City's capacity to regulate trafficking is in fact connected to what we need to be able to defend doing within the state of Illinois or throughout the country.
Now, the issue is whether cities and states can file their own laws. And right now, this is about a lawsuit brought by the gun manufacturers, I believe. But hasn't the Supreme Court already upheld the right of states to pass their own gun regulations?
Well, most certainly. Be it the NRA or other advocates for gun access to guns will continuously find different angles and avenues to sue and to challenge those of us who are trying to regulate and keep the public safe. There's no inconsistency with allowing people to embrace sportsman activities with guns or even possess guns for self-defense. There's no inconsistency between that and making sure that we put in place laws to make sure that guns don't get into the hands of people who will do harm with them. And that's the intent of legislatures throughout this country and certainly municipalities as well as attorneys general.
Can I ask what kind of new or different or modified laws do you want to see here in Illinois, given all the concerns among people here?
Well, I think, you know, we took a major step with gun dealer licensing. And it's important to make sure that we hold dealers, not all dealers are bad actors, but there are some where a large percentage of guns involved in crimes are coming out of specific dealers, and so we have to have the capacity to regulate them. However, everything we do is not just through legislating. My office is taking on trying to build out our capacity to track guns that have been utilized in the commission of a crime. It mirrors something that has been previously done by the New York Attorney General's office and quite frankly, by the Chicago Police Department on a local level. But again, the guns come from outside of the city of Chicago. And so we want to build out a platform statewide that allows us to share data with the various law enforcement departments from different municipalities so we are better able to track guns from origin to the point that they're utilized in the commission of a crime. If we're able to collect that data, it better equips us to go after those who are intentionally trafficking guns into the people who will do harm with them and hold them accountable.
Do you also want to see things like some of the other things that people are talking about, either bans on high-capacity magazines, bans on assault weapons? And I know that that raises a whole lot of issues, too.
Yeah, and we continue to strive for reasonableness, you know. While in the legislature, we tried to limit the number of guns individuals could buy per month. It was once a bill that tried to limit it to 10 a month that didn't advance. You know, we tried to limit the number of bullets that could be in a clip. That did not advance, and so you run up against walls in the legislature. But again, I think we need to make efforts outside of, in addition to legislating. You know, too often we turn solely to, oh, we need new gun laws. Well, we also need investment in communities. We also need to make sure that we have trauma-informed care for those who are survivors of gun violence. Because one of the things that I'm fully aware of, and that's why while a legislator, I sponsored legislation to pilot trauma recovery centers, hospital-based trauma recovery centers, to make sure that those who were exposed or are made victim by way of gun violence have services. Because one of the things that we know is that there's cycles of crime. And those who are initially survivors or witnesses of gun violence and suffer the trauma of gun violence can evolve into being perpetrators of the same violence that they were once a victim of. That's why in our office, where we've historically dealt with delivering services to crime victims, we had a heavy emphasis prior to my tenure on sexual assault and domestic violence, and we continue that. And we continue that at the same level and at an increased level. However, we cannot ignore those who were exposed and who have suffered the trauma of gun violence. And so we're expanding our service with a focus on trying to make sure we get services to survivors of gun violence.
I want to turn to another dimension of the kind of thing that we're talking about, and that is working with other attorneys general around the country. And I know there are a number of things that you're doing. I want to touch on a couple of them, and might as well touch on the one that you're highlighting right now, even mm-hmm. as we are recording this, and that is filing a lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Homeland Security over what's called the public charge rule, and basically is something other than the bring us your tired and you're poor and you're wretched yearning to be free, which is on the Statue of Liberty. What is that lawsuit to do?
Well, as you may remember, Craig, when I was a candidate for Attorney General, I responded to a discriminatory comment that our president made about Haiti, immigrants from Haiti and other countries, referring to them as coming from S-hole countries. And around the same time, he expressed a preference for immigrants that come from countries such as Norway. And it was a demonstration of his discrimination in terms of his posture towards immigration into this country. This country has always been known as a nation of immigrants. The public charge rule that's being suggested by DHS suggests to expand the categories of public assistance that are considered when considering somebody's applications for citizenship. And so what it in effect does is it renders individuals, sometimes individuals who are permanent residents, some individuals who may have children who are citizens, unable to access these services or otherwise risk deportation.
Yeah, so basically, and I think some of the representatives of the Trump administration have been quoted as saying, well, you know, we want the tired and the poor, but we want the tired and the poor who can stand on their own two feet. In other words, that they're not really that poor. And do you think, though, that the majority of the people of the United States are ready to support that kind of attitude that says, no, we need to help everybody? Or are people becoming more and more like the kind that say, yeah, but not with my money, not with my tax dollars. I don't want to take care of people who aren't even citizens.
Well, the irony is it's the tax dollars of certain of these individuals as well. We're talking about people who are working here and paying taxes as well, and they may have children that may be beneficiaries, children who are citizens that may be beneficiaries of the CHIP program, for example. So we're not talking about people who are just coming into the country and just being total dependents. We're talking about people who are contributing to lifting up this country, and that's the origin of this country. You know, Donald Trump's ancestry doesn't originate from within the United States, and so he himself is a descendant of immigrants, and so we have to appreciate that the contributions that are made to this country's functioning comes from the immigrant population as well. We know these people as our neighbors, as people who work with us, and who have children who are citizens. And so it's unconscionable that there's this move towards a discriminatory approach to how we approach our immigration policy.
I want to ask you, though, all these actions that the attorneys general are taking, especially where you're going into court, where it's not just you're appealing to Congress, are in an atmosphere where the president, through his appointments, has been transforming the federal courts of the United States so that they are more conservative. And are those actions that you're filing going to be falling on increasingly deaf ears?
Well, I would like to believe not. notwithstanding that I may have my, every time there's an appointment to the Supreme Court, I may have my opinion one way or another of a candidate that I may prefer more than another. By and large, all the people who tend to be appointed to the highest court are people who are, you know, learned scholars. And, you know, they may have certain leanings, and they certainly do. I mean, you've got different, you've got conservative justices, and you have justices who are more progressive in their approach to the law. But some of the president's actions are so contrary to the Constitution, and even conservative justices like to strictly apply the Constitution. And so as a result of that, you know, I remain hopeful that even the justices that may be closer to embracing some of the president's policies, if they're at home having coffee, will apply the law as the law should be applied to the specific actions being taken by the president or his administration.
The Supreme Court's one thing. Are you seeing any effects at the lower level, at the federal district courts?
Well, certainly they're different circuits, courts, court of appeals circuits, as well as different districts, might have a different leaning depending on what part of the country you're in. But it's not just a manifestation of Donald Trump. It's always been like that, depending on what the politics in that region of the nation may be, and how suggestions that come from U.S. senators from within states as to candidates for district court or courts of appeals may be suggested up to the president, whoever that president is at the time. So that's nothing new. It's been like that for some time.
You're listening to WBBM News Radio's At Issue. I'm political editor Craig Delamore. My guest is Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul. Before we leave the whole issue of the attorneys general, are there any other joint actions that you feel ought to be highlighted?
Yeah, well, there.
I know there's a bunch of them.
You know, I literally meet twice a week with my own staff, and we call it. In fact, we're going to have our meeting shortly after I leave you here today. I literally meet a couple of times a week for a multi-state meeting to go over federal actions that have been taken that are contrary to what we believe are good policies, or contrary to the Constitution, contrary to established law. And so whether it's attacks on reproductive rights, we are leading, we're co-leading with New York an action to try to fight discriminatory policies in employment against people based on their sexual orientation and their gender identity. We're leading again. We led in a comment letter with regards to a housing policy that could be discriminatory against individuals based on their gender identity or sexual orientation. Various immigration actions, rollbacks on environmental protection, rollbacks on policies that protect college students from being preyed on by predatory lenders. He's a gift that keeps on giving, and it keeps us active. I participate on a conference call on a weekly basis with my colleagues from throughout the country, the attorneys general from throughout the country. And I'd say on about I've been in office 7 months. I think at least 6 or 7 occasions I've met physically out of state with attorneys general, sometimes on a partisan basis and sometimes on a bipartisan basis, because we also collaborate on a bipartisan basis the opioid investigation and litigation that we're involved with on a multi-state level is something that we're engaged in on a bipartisan basis. Fighting against robocalls is something that we engage in on a bipartisan basis. Encouraging regulations for CBD products. There are multiple things that we work on a bipartisan basis. So I don't want to create a perception that it's Democrats against Republicans all of the times. I count amongst my new friends some Republican attorney generals as attorneys general as well.
Well, I want to move to a few things that are specifically geared toward Illinois. One is we are slowly moving toward the legalization of recreational marijuana here in Illinois. Obviously, there are some business and just logistical concerns, but what law enforcement concerns are you going to be watching as you see all of this worked out before the pot law takes full effect, which is really next year?
Well, I mean, I think there are concerns that are already exist. You'd have to have your head in the sand to not believe there wasn't already widespread use of cannabis within the state of Illinois and throughout our country, for that matter. And so one of the things that you have to deal with is how you deal with driving under the influence of cannabis. The science on cannabis hasn't progressed yet to where we are with alcohol, for example. So with alcohol, we have a 0.08 threshold standard, and it's a little bit more complicated with marijuana because it stays in your system longer, and it could be in your system a day or two later when you're no longer impaired by having used it. And so there are complications that come with that. But, you know, just as with alcohol, there are field sobriety tests, and there are other indicators of whether one is impaired in their driving capacity. There are employment issues that will arise, where people have historically disciplined employees for having marijuana in their system. And so we have to evolve with the legalization.
Do you believe that police departments across the state are going to be ready in January for dealing with the issue of driving while under the influence?
Well, as I said, they've had to deal with it already. It's nothing. It's not as if people haven't been arrested and charged with driving under the influence of marijuana already, because people have smoked pot and gotten behind a wheel, and so to the extent that it's impaired their driving, then they've been pulled over, and their eyes are bloodshot red, and there's a smell of marijuana in the car, an officer may suspect that somebody's under the influence. That has existed for some time. The difference now is that we're legalizing the substance. Alcohol is legalized now, yet you know we still are capable of arresting people who are driving under the influence of alcohol.
Good point. I do want to talk about the Chicago Police Department, because your office, admittedly, begun under Lisa Madigan, but did participate and frankly pushed the city of Chicago into a consent decree that now will govern how police reform is done in the city. How is your office and, frankly, the federal court monitoring the progress that the city is trying to make?
Yes, so we're still in the early stages of the implementation of the consent decree, which was just entered in March of this year. So in March of The judge approved the consent decree in January, and it became effective at the end of March, at which point he appointed Maggie Hickey to be the monitor for the consent decree, and he appointed retired judge David Core to be the special master to help the court also observe the progress. We've since also elected a new mayor of the city of Chicago who's not foreign to the topic of law enforcement reform. She served on the police board, and she also chaired a task force on which I served on one of the committees. And so she did an admirable job serving on the task force. I think, and this is not meant to be a knock on her predecessor, I think she's a little bit more familiar with the intricacies of dealing with reform and the different topics that are connected to the consent decree and law enforcement generally. She's a former federal prosecutor. I had an initial meeting with her maybe a couple of months ago, and I feel confident that we will be able to work together on the implementation of the consent decree.
I do want to talk about one other department, and that's a state one, the Department of Children and Family Services, because I know that there are still cases where DCFS may not have performed as well as it should, and I know you had to kind of issue a warning to DCFS because it wasn't giving a news organization some information that it was seeking about which offices were complying with the law and may not have been. How's that going, and how are you able to keep an eye on that?
Well, one of the things that you're highlighting there is a function within our office of making sure that we have transparency in government, not only in state government, but at the local level. We have a public access counselor, and we make rulings on whether people should have, through the Freedom of Information Act and through Open Meetings Act, whether people should, regular citizens and journalists should have access to information. And oftentimes it's our prodding that gets either state agencies or local governments to finally release information. Transparency is important. Obviously, there are exemptions to FOIA and their circumstances, and in DCFS, that there are privacy concerns that must be observed. So it's not always black and white. We have to come in and make judgments as to whether information should be released. With regards to the functioning of DCFS itself, as a former child welfare prosecutor, we've got to protect our kids, and we've got to make sure that the agencies that are charged of taking care of kids who have either been abused in their own household or in some other place are taken care of once they come into custody of the state.
Well, thank you. That is going to be the final word. We are out of time. Thank you, Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul, for spending this half hour with us. To our listeners, if you'd like a copy of this program or just to hear it again, please visit our website, WBBMNewsRadio.com. You'll also find our podcast on radio.com. I'll be back next week with another edition of At Issue, and I hope you'll be listening. Until then, I'm Craig Delamore, News Radio 780 and 105.9 FM.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.